37 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Support comes from the Studio of Classical Dance Arts, presenting the story of the Nutcracker December 12th and 13th at the Rita on the UW Parkside campus, featuring over 80 local students and guest artists from the Joffrey Ballet. Tickets and information at classicaldancearts.com. Support for The Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for The Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Before we begin today's morning show, we want to remind you that your pledge to Wisconsin Public Radio, if you have not yet done so this year, would be very, very much appreciated. The toll-free number you can call anytime today is 888-202-2552, 888-202-2552. And when you do so, when you do call, please mention that you're a listener to WGTD and to The Morning Show, and thank you for your support. We are looking at the nation of China on today's morning show, but we are looking at it through the eyes of Peter Navarro, who is a professor at the Paul Mirage School of Business at the University of California, Irvine. He is someone who has written extensively about Asia, has lived there, has worked there, written a number of different books about China in particular, and his newest book is called Crouching Tiger: What China's Militarism Means for the World. It is the contention of Peter Navarro that not only is China building up its own military capabilities at breathtaking pace, but is doing so in a way that should have all of us in the West very, very concerned. That although there may be rhetoric on the surface that refers to China's peaceful rise in prominence, he suspects that, in fact, there is very significant potential there for China to, in fact, be building up its military capabilities and other capabilities of warfare with more sinister purposes, perhaps, in mind. And his book not only chronicles the dimensions of this military buildup in China, but also examines what perhaps is behind it and some avenues which Western powers like the United States might want to consider in terms of combating what he describes as a needless to say, very worrisome situation. Again, the book is called Crouching Tiger: What China's Militarism Means for the World. It's published by Prometheus Books. And Peter Navarro, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
A pleasure to be with you, sir.
Glad to be talking with you. China is one of those nations which, of course, the United States has had an intriguing and kind of checkered relationship. And those of us of a certain age, of course, certainly remember the days still very vividly when China, in many respects at least, was largely shut off from the Western world. And, of course, now we live in a very, very different situation. Before we start talking about your book, I wonder if you could just say a word about what it is like for you as someone who has studied China a great deal, lived there, worked there, to sort of navigate the changing relationship which our two nations have had over the decades.
Well, the Chinese curse, you know, may you live in interesting times, I think is coming to fruition, because with each passing day, China becomes more and more interesting. I mean, I originally became familiar with Asia, essentially, when I was in the Peace Corps in Southeast Asia and traveled extensively there while I was there. And you couldn't help but see the impact of China, Chinese business interests in all of these countries. But at the same time that this was going on, the state of China itself was an autarkic state, a backward state, closed off to the world. And you know, we see the Nixon-Kissinger event in the 70s where the opening begins, essentially. We go to 1979 when Deng Xiaoping opens China to the world and trade begins. We see in 2001 when China comes into the World Trade Organization and the floodgates open for China's goods. We see China growing 10% a year for more than three decades and morphing from this very backward power that could only make cheap toys and cheap electronics into a global powerhouse. And in many ways, we'd love to be applauding that rise, because the whole assumption politically over that time was that if we engaged with China economically, that somehow over time it would become more peaceful and democratic and stable, like other countries which have undergone that kind of process have become. What's disconcerting and interesting to me, however, is that the rise of China economically has not made it more peaceful and democratic. It's simply consolidated the hold of the Chinese Communist Party on the people. And, you know, the money you and I spend on Made in China at the big box retailers is now going to fund a very well-oiled and well-financed war machine, essentially, that appears to have some significant revanchist ambitions, much like Russia has in Eastern Europe and the Ukraine. So it's a picture that's emerging that a lot of people aren't paying attention to because of turmoil in other parts of the world. But it's something that I've followed very, very carefully, because I think the key really to unlocking the mystery of why our economy is so bad and why things are becoming more unstable in Asia really may be found in dealing with a rising China.
You certainly try to take a historically long view of this current situation. And as a matter of fact, in the first chapter of your book, as you discuss the so-called security dilemma, which often leads to, in your words, a vicious escalatory spiral, you evoke two names very familiar to many of us, namely Athens and Sparta. Explain to us exactly how this is apropos, applicable to current-day China and the United States.
Sure. And one of the things I tell you is that much of the book and film, Crouching Tiger, is based on extensive interviews with experts, people like John Mearsheimer, University of Chicago. And there is this construct called the Thucydides trap that Graham Allison at Harvard has come up with. And basically, it's an academic study which looks at the numerous instances where rising powers have encountered established powers. And the cradle of that whole idea is Athens v. Sparta. Sparta, back centuries ago, was the reigning superpower of that area. Much like the United States is the reigning superpower of today, Athens was the upstart. And the analysis that Allison goes through and Mearsheimer goes through is that there are very good reasons why war was inevitable between the two, because of a lack of trust between them. And historically, about 75% of the time when we've had rising powers meet established powers, war has indeed ensued. So I start off the book with that simply to say, hey, there's a high probability here that we're going to have conflict with China. But the whole point of the book is to figure out ways so that does not happen. And I do indeed try to look at this whole problem from an historical view. For example, I look at the history of Chinese aggression going back to the founding of the People's Republic in Fort. Many people know this, but historically, China has a long history of invading other countries, particularly ones that it was friends with. It invaded India in 1962. It invaded Vietnam in 1979. It invaded the Soviet Union over some small islands in the Pamir mountain range. It's not this peaceful Confucian state that some would have you believe, and therein lies the tale.
Hmm. You also, to turn the table there, also remind us that China itself has been invaded quite a number of times over the last couple of hundred years, and in fact endured what apparently it thinks of as its century of humiliation. And of course, this is then brought up by some as a perfectly logical explanation for why China would be building up its military capability to avoid any repeat of such humiliating experiences. You don't find this to be convincing.
I do and I don't. And let me explain the Crunchy Niger book. I wrote it to be accessible to people as what I call a geopolitical detective story. And so that every chapter, they're short, they provide clues and evidence, and it kind of propels the narrative and mystery along. But the underlying idea is that what you want to do is, first of all, you want to look at the intentions of China. Are they good? Are they bad? If they're bad, you have to look at the capabilities. Are they strong? Are they weak? If they're weak, you don't have to worry. If they're strong, you do. And then if they're strong, then you have to look for the flashpoints for conflict and ultimately figure out ways to avoid that conflict. So that's the underlying thing. So you begin with the intentions question, and inevitably you understand that China has a very legitimate reason. Let's give the dragon its due for building up its military based on the so-called century of humiliation, which lasted roughly from 1839, when Great Britain came in and seized all its harbors and conducted its opium wars, to the invasion of the Imperial Japan, brutal, brutal conquest. The French and Germans, by the way, were equally brutal in terms of taking parts of China. And it didn't end until 1949 when Japan surrendered. And then, of course, in 45. And then in 1949, of course, the Communist Party state was established. And so, based on that history, which is drummed into every Chinese citizen in their history books, there's no question they need a strong military. There's also no question they need a strong military to defend the global trade route now that they are a nation whose growth is heavily dependent on exports. I get that. We all should understand that. But as Dean Chang from the Heritage Institute says in the book and film, it's okay for them to be building weapons to defend their homeland and protect their trading routes, but it's quite another thing when they start building weapons which are offensive in nature, designed to push the U.S. out of the Western Pacific and to basically subdue countries like Japan so that they can take territory like the Senkaku Islands from Japan. And therein lies the tale.
Hmm.
It's not a black or white thing. It's like, hey, they got good reasons to do this, but the danger is they got really bad reasons to do it as well. And they've told us firsthand that they're going to do the bad things. They make no secret about that. They claim 80% of the South China Sea. They want to take back Taiwan, which the U.S. has already had conflict three times with over China. They want to take the Senkaku Islands from Japan.
You make a very good point at the opening of Chapter 6 as you begin sort of chronicling the impressive military expansion in China. When you caution us against drawing simplistic conclusions from the fact that the United States is still outspending China by quite a significant margin when it comes to military spending. But you say that behind that simple truth is a more complicated reality, which is not very reassuring to anybody who is worried about China. What is sort of the more complicated picture behind that simple truth that the U.S. is outspending China when it comes to the military?
That's a great question, and I should say that the problem is whenever you raise the issue of China, there's certain kind of go-to things. It's like, oh, we have conflict, we trade too much with them, or, well, who's the warmonger? It's the United States. We spend three times as much as they do, okay? But let's dissect that spending issue. First of all, there's the validity of the numbers question itself. What China reports that they spend is far less than they actually spend. But even if you believe those numbers, there's a couple other mitigating circumstances here when you think about the problem. First of all, China building up its military needs to focus just on the Asia Pacific. We are spread out all over the globe. So we've got 10 aircraft carriers, but only maybe two of them or three of them are in the Asian theater at any one time. And that's the same with all of our forces around the world. So that's number one. And number two, of course, is the production of weapons in China is far, far cheaper than it is in the United States. They are the factory floor. The labor's cheaper. They don't have any environmental rules to speak of. They have an undervalued currency that allows them to produce more cheaply. And they're the factory floor of the world. So they can actually produce their weapons much more cheaply. So those two things alone. And then the third part of it, which American taxpayers should be outraged about, is like a lot of the cost of us developing our defense systems basically are in the research and development to build the next stealth fighter or the Aegis battle management system or whatever. And all China does is rip that stuff off from the Pentagon. They steal what is effectively the equivalent of billions and billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars worth of our defense technology, and then they use it essentially for free. So I think that people should not buy into the argument that we spend more. It actually should be worrisome that they are able to spend less and field what is an increasingly impressive military. And, of course, as they continue to outpace our growth, the trend lines will cross, and they'll pretty much be able to build anything they want, even as we're having difficulty building what we need.
Can you say a quick word about something called the Underground Great Wall of China? As you give us details about this military buildup, this is actually one of the most disconcerting facets of it. What is the so-called Underground Great Wall of China?
It's first of all, you have to know that Mao Zedong was absolutely infatuated with the idea of building tunnels to protect China, and then from what it viewed as the nuclear bomb threats from the Soviet Union. So going back to the Mao years in the early 50s, China began building this huge tunnel complex, which is crisscrosses the country and is over 3,000 miles of tunnels. And for any Vietnam vets who might be listening to this, they're well familiar, for example, with the tunnels of Kuchi in Vietnam. I mean, tunnel warfare is a common part of the Asian landscape. And a few years ago, with great fanfare on Chinese TV, the existence of these tunnels were revealed, and the world was shown footage of these tunnels where, if you can imagine, like two wide-lane freeways, where big trucks with missiles and also light rail with missiles could move to launch points, different launch points, and basically mobile missile launchers underneath the ground that could move to different launch points. I mean, these are virtually indestructible. I mean, we don't know where they are and where they're going to shoot from, so there's no way we can counter them at point of launch. And one of the problems here, my friend, is that while the U.S. and Russia have been in the START treaty for many years now, and we purposely restrict the number of warheads and missiles we build and the kinds of missiles we build, China has been under no such restrictions. So Phil Carver, Georgetown University professor, did a big study of all this, and his conclusion was, yeah, these tunnels exist. Yeah, we know there's a bunch of missiles down there, but we have no idea whether they have 300 or 3,000 or anything in between. But we do know that that great underground wall is a serious, serious strategic threat.
You outline other specific facets of China's military buildup, including submarines and missiles and even military might, which might be wielded in space. I thought one of the most intriguing chapters of your book was one titled The Dark Strategic Beauty of the Non-Kinetic Three Warfares, in which you take us beyond the realm of, let's say, more conventional warfare and into the realms of other kinds of warfare, other kinds of weapons, so to speak, which can be, in some respects, just as destructive, perhaps more destructive than the everyday missile, for instance. Outline for our listeners these three kinds of warfare beyond conventional warfare and the ways in which China seems to be thinking about these and engaged in them and improving on them in ways that that we are not.
Sure. And I would tell you that one of the joys, essentially, of writing the Crouching Tiger book was sitting down with experts and interviewing them. And the three warfares, I think that the top scholar on the three warfares in the United States is a gentleman named Stephen Halper. Lives out in Virginia, was very gracious to let me and my film crew in there. I sat with him for 3 hours, basically going over a 500-page report he'd done for the Office of Net Assessment in the Pentagon about the three warfares. And the essence of the three warfares, my friend, is that China recognizes that in today's world, kinetic warfare can often lead to things like economic sanctions and international opprobrium and UN sanctions. And they have officially incorporated into their strategic warfare doctrine this whole notion of non-kinetic warfare called the three warfares. What are they? Legal and psychological and media warfare. And the idea would simply be, I'll give you an example. China has been very aggressive in the South China Sea in terms of taking territory from the Philippines. Scarborough Shoal, they covet Second Thomas Shoal, the Second Thomas Creek. And so the three warfares would be, you start with the legal warfare, where China makes a spurious legal claim to 80% of the South China Sea based on their so-called nine-dash line. So they say, okay, that's ours, not yours. And then they use psychological warfare on the Philippines by putting pressure on the Philippines economically by, for example, banning the tourism trade or putting restrictions on their banana exports, which, interestingly enough, were a significant part of the Philippine economy. And they basically turn the screws on the Philippines to make the Philippines believe that China has this coercive power to take what it wants, right? And then they use the media warfare to construct a narrative about how the Philippines basically took this land illegally from the poor Chinese. They do the same thing with the Japanese in the East China Sea over the Senkaku Islands. And so they use these three warfares basically to construct a narrative. And Stephen Halper has a beautiful quote about how it's not the country with the best weapons that's going to win the wars, it's the one with the best narrative. So this is what's going on. And the problem is that under the three warfares, you can never trust anything that the Chinese say. They regularly, on a minute-by-minute basis, are hacking our businesses, and they're hacking our Pentagon. Yet, at the very top of the leadership, the Xi Jinping says, no, we don't do that. And that's part of the three warfare. It goes back to Herman Goebbels in the media, you know, say it enough to believe it. And it's a very dangerous form of non-kinetic warfare because you can achieve the same goals as you can with missiles and bombs and often do it better.
And you do, in your chapter devoted to cyber warfare, say that no country has been more aggressive in seeking to develop its cyber warfare capabilities than China. That's that is a warning worth heeding.
Indeed, and one of my goals with this book, in fact, the most important goal of this book really is to have this whole topic to be part of the national dialogue of the presidential campaign, the 2016 election, and get the candidates talking. And you know, the question I would pose to the presidential candidates is this: do you consider cyber attacks on our Pentagon and on our businesses to be acts of war? And if so, what do you intend to do about that? Because we've not been treating what China has been doing as such. We kind of, like the Obama administration in particular, has kind of looked at it and started to talk a little tough on it, but we're not willing to acknowledge that when China goes in and steals the designs for our F-22 and F-35 and Aegis battle management systems and then goes builds versions of that to defeat us in the Pacific, that they are a serious strategic rival, which is directly threatening this country. We need to have that epiphany. We just really need to have that discussion.
Do you have time for just a couple more questions?
Sure, whatever you need, sir.
Let me reintroduce you. My guest is Peter Navarro, and we are talking about his brand new book, which is called Crouching Tiger: What China's Militarism Means for the World. In the book, Mr. Navarro not only chronicles the dimensions of China's military buildup, but also presents some possible scenarios in terms of why they are doing so, and also presents some scenarios in terms of what we in the West might think about as a strategic response to what is going on in China. I wonder if you could say a word, Mr. Navarro, about the means by which you've gathered some of this information, specifically about China's own military buildup. You said at one point that, in a sense, they are making no secret of it, that part of the point of it is for the rest of the world to know that this buildup, in fact, is occurring. Just explain how open China, in fact, is, because, of course, we think of it also as a nation in which information is restricted, at least as much as is possible in this modern world in which we live. How is it that this kind of information is so freely available? Is it, in fact, that they want us to have this information?
Let me start with the point I made earlier about how this book is based on extensive interviews with a number of experts. And in thinking about how we know so much about what China's telling us, I mean, some of it's on their CCTV, right? You can watch television programs which have been captured on YouTube that the Chinese citizens watch. And I show this in a film of them launching intercontinental ballistic missiles from their homeland and hitting New York. You can even see the Statue of Liberty before the big flash goes. So, you know, they've had programs about the Great Underground Wall and their missile system. So they're telling us about some of that. But the other way that I got information from the Chinese for this book was to interview people like Toshi Yoshihara of the U.S. Naval War College and his colleague Lyle Goldstein of the Naval War College. Toshi Yoshihara is a fascinating person. He wrote a book with Jim Holmes called Red Star Over the Pacific, which I recommend highly. But he's a guy who was born in Japan, grew up in Taiwan, speaks fluent Mandarin, and he, like many of the scholars at the Naval War College, spends hours and hours a day basically reading the Chinese literature, which is available on the internet. He gets copies of stuff from people in China who were part of the Navy, and you know, you read this stuff, and it's like, we're doing X, Y, and Z. You know, we're building the anti-ship ballistic missile, basically, and we call it a carrier killer. And we want to launch that from the mainland of China and hit an American aircraft carrier, and we want them out. So that's the thing. There's no secrets here. I mean, when people say, oh, China, you would never do that, or they don't want to go to war, it's like, well, wait a minute. Read what they're writing, listen to what they're saying, and watch what the people of China are viewing. And there's no question, there's absolutely no question that they have essentially an imperial hegemonic view of the role of China in Asia, just as Russia wants to reclaim the glory of the Soviet Union. China wants to reclaim the glory of the Chinese dynasties, and we need to take that seriously.
Some people would look at that kind of situation and suggest that it is important not to overreact to what might be, more than anything, just aggressive posturing. And particularly the reason that concern comes to mind is because that is often what is said about Mr. Putin, that he is very good at posturing, but in fact some of the most outrageous claims which he makes should not be interpreted as literal goals which he is literally pursuing. That sometimes those kind of grandiose statements serve another kind of purpose. I think that is not where you fall, though, in terms of how you interpret this kind of rhetoric.
Well, I understand the need not to overreact to anything, but there's a saying that one of my experts shared with me, Michael Pillsbury, about kind of the Chinese, and I think it's probably the Russian philosophy as well. It's like, you probe. What you do is you probe with a bayonet. And you know, if you meet softness, you continue to probe further. If you meet hard steel, you retreat. And so, you know, in a lot of ways, that's what Putin is doing. That's what Xi Jinping is doing in China. But, I mean, I don't see at this point how anybody can underestimate Vladimir Putin. I mean, he does hold the Crimea now. He does control much of the part of Ukraine where the Russian speakers tend to live. He did work his way with Georgia, and he's got the Baltic states cowed, essentially, and unwilling to speak out against Russia. So I can't – I mean, anybody says that Putin's not outmaneuvering the White House and basically at least getting some of his way amidst all the bombast, I think is misreading that chessboard. But China – I mean, China is in a whole different league. I mean, China has a military which is going to be much more capable than the Russians could ever be. They've got the world's manufacturing floor, and they have a very clear agenda of what they want. It's a checklist, and it's basically anathema to maintaining peace, stability, and democracy in Asia. And again, therein lies the tale.
One of the ways in which this whole scenario which you are presenting might seem unbelievable is the fact that in some respects China and the United States enjoy a much more powerful, potent, and in at least some respects, relatively friendly relationship than has been the case in the past, in terms of economic trade between the two nations and in terms of artistic exchanges and in other respects. We are not the same sort of wary enemies of one another that we once were in the relatively recent past. I think you are suggesting that we need to be careful about not feeling too complacent within that particular scenario. How would you, as someone who's lived in China, worked in China, describe the relationship between our two nations in terms of just how close, how friendly is it? And how does that square then with this other scenario that you are painting in your book, Crouching Tiger?
Well, I think there's a fairly large segment of the American population that has a idealized view of China as a Confucian state with a 5,000-year history of art and culture and invention, and it's a warm and fuzzy feeling towards China, and it's certainly that history exists. I certainly think that there's a lot of people. I'm at the University of California, Irvine. We have a tremendous amount of Chinese students that come over, both at the undergraduate and doctoral level. I mean, the Chinese people have integrated well into American society in many different ways. And I've always said that this is not about the Chinese people or even the Chinese character itself. It's about the Chinese Communist Party with an agenda, which at the economic level has been to grow China using essentially mercantilist state capitalism. They do it very well, but they've done it at the expense of our jobs and factories. But at the military level, they are proceeding apace with a vision. They have this vision. It's the 2050 vision. That's the essentially 100-year anniversary of the Chinese Communist Party. According to Chinese doctrine, they want to be able to control much of Asia by the year 2050. They're going about their business to do it. So, I mean, we need to pay attention to that. That's 50% of the population, 70% of the world's growth. We're a trading nation that wants to maintain peace and stability and democracy in the world for our own self-interest as well as for greater moral purposes. And we have to kind of take off the rose-colored glasses and see China for what it is today.
When you speak about China in that respect, who or what exactly are you talking about? I mean, are you talking about the people of China, the general population? Are you talking about the overall government? Are you talking about a select few government figures? I mean, when you talk about us needing to be concerned about China, towards whom should we be directing our concern?
That's such a wonderful question. And there's two people that I interviewed for the Crouching Tiger book and film, David Lampton of Johns Hopkins University, and Stephanie Klein Albrand. And they both talk about how, despite the fact that China is an authoritarian communist state ruled by the Chinese Communist Party, it has a lot of commonality with the kind of Madisonian world of a mischief of factions, where you have special interests competing for different goals that are bringing China into conflict with the United States. So, you know, when I talk about China, it's the same problem when you were talking about America. You know, which America are we really talking about? But I can tell you the parts of China that are worrisome. I mean, you start with the Chinese Communist Party itself. I mean, it's mostly a group of very old men who want to basically control the population, control what the people think and what they say. And you know, they have a very effective system of doing that, whether it's their cyber cops or whether it's their forced labor camps or whatever. They are very intent on controlling the narrative. So I fear the Orwellian aspect of China. They have a very thriving military-industrial complex, which is even stronger than the U.S. one, because in China, the military is allowed actually to engage in free enterprise, essentially, and run a bunch of companies and make money and export things just like the business sector, and they're doing that quite well. And so, you know, like the military is like militaries everywhere. What do they want to do? They want to build more weapon systems, and they want to go out there and take more territory. So, you know, I fear that. I fear their business sector, because their business sector, even as they exploit their own people in the sweatshops and ruin their pollution, and ruin their air with pollution, basically they're basically ruining our economy with their unfair trade practices, weakening us, making it us very difficult to have a tax base to fix our roads or have a great education system. So that's a part of China I fear, and probably the scariest part of China right now is the nationalist wing, primarily youth in China, who the central government whips up into a frenzy over things like the Senkaku Islands, and you wind up with riots in China against Japan. So there's a lot of things going on in China, but at the end of the day, we know that the government has territorial ambitions, like Putin has in Eastern Europe, and we know that they're growing capabilities to enforce those territorial claims. And we know that the only thing really standing in their way is the U.S. military, which they want out of Asia. And we need to talk about that. We need to have that discussion at the presidential election. We need the CNN moderator and the ABC moderator and the Fox moderator to stop asking stupid questions and really get to the heart of good ones. Because, you know, so far in the presidential debates, I have not been impressed with the discussion of foreign policy. And this is going to be an election, I think, about foreign policy.
In the last portion of your book, you first of all lay out what might be some possible responses by the United States to this threat from China, responses which you consider to be misguided and unlikely to achieve anything close to the kind of result that we might want. And then you lay out what you see as probably a wiser course of action in your opinion. Let's talk about, first of all, kind of the potential responses, particularly the one about economic engagement. I mean, is there a way in which by just continuing to engage economically with China the way that we are in fairly aggressive fashion, that in and of itself is likely to, in a sense, preserve the peace between our two nations and fend off any of these darker possibilities outlined in your book? What's the problem with that scenario, in your opinion?
That scenario is a tried and true path to failure. It's basically the argument that trade trumps invade. And the idea here is simply that, wow, you know, they're our biggest trading partner. We'd never have conflict because that would kill the golden goose that's laid the golden egg, right? Historically, you could just go back to 1914, put yourself in a time machine, and that would be exactly the same argument that said that you can never have a war between Kaiser Germany and Great Britain because of the tremendous trade between them. It's a very, very high-risk strategy to depend simply on economic engagement to keep the peace because it often fails. And it particularly fails when the economic engagement is involved in things like natural resources. For example, China depends on the Persian Gulf and Africa for a large percentage of its oil imports. And when countries are afraid of another country interdicting their supplies, you can have war as well. I mean, part of the reason why Kaiser Germany went to war against Great Britain was that Great Britain and France were trying to restrict their iron ore and oil so that Kaiser Germany couldn't grow. So this whole idea that economics is a surefire key to peace is just wrong. And we, you know, we've been relying on that for 30 some odd years now with China, and it's ultimately not going to work.
You lay out in the last chapter of the book a scenario which you call Pathways to Peace Through Strength. In the last minute or so that remains to us, outline the ways in which we need to think about our own strength, and beyond just the simple matter of our military, what are other ways in which the United States needs to safeguard and, in your view, even escalate its own strength?
Yeah, this brings us right to the notion of the presidential election, because what we need to do should be the platform of the presidential candidates, every single one of them. And the one who adopts this platform will win. And it's a platform that I borrowed directly from the Chinese. It's a platform called comprehensive national power. The Chinese don't believe that comprehensive national power grows from the point of a gun, okay? Military strength is certainly important. But the comprehensive national power idea is you need a strong economy, basically, in order to create the wealth to finance your weapon systems. In order to have a strong economy, you need a strong educational system so that people will be able to produce and innovate. You need a favorable business climate. You need a stable and well-functioning political system, which, frankly, I don't think we have right now. We have a stalemate between two competing ideologies, which are getting in the way of us solving concrete problems that we face. So the answer here, the pathway to peace that will work, is a focus in this country on comprehensive power that will build this country back to the greatness it once had across multiple lines, whether education, economics, militarily, innovation. These are the things we need to focus on, and these are the things, frankly, that we need the presidential debates to be about right now. I think that's what the American people ultimately want.
The book, again, is titled Crouching Tiger, What China's Militarism Means for the World. The book is published by Prometheus Books, and the book includes extensive footnotes through each and every chapter. And the author, Peter Navarro. Peter Navarro, I thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show. Before we let you go, please clarify the matter of the film of the same name, which you helped to create, and tell our listeners how they can view that film if they want to.
Sure. The website for the book and film is crouchingtiger.net. It's crouchingtiger.net. If you go to that and buy the book, you'll get a free copy of the film. It's a 45-minute standalone film that is part of what's going to be an 11-episode miniseries that takes you through the entire argument that the book is based on. This is my second book-film combination. I actually showed my first film in your city, Death by China, some years ago. And I'd encourage people to just go to that website, crouchingtiger.net. If nothing else, you can watch 35 short clips of each of the experts that appear in the film, and it's very interesting to do that.
Peter Navarro, my thanks to you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
And thank you so much for the time.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Jamie Johnson and Doug Instanis from the Racine Theater Guild talking about the production of Mary Poppins, which opened this past Friday and runs for several more weekends. Support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for The Morning Show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. Information at carthage.edu/grad. Today's going to be cloudy and mild, a high of 49 degrees, a 30% chance of light rain tonight with a low of 42 degrees. Tomorrow should be partly sunny and mild, a high of 46 degrees. Thursday, under partly sunny skies, we're actually going to warm to 55 degrees. Partly sunny as well on Friday, close to 50 for a high. A chance of light rain returns to the forecast on Saturday. up in the mid-50s once again. Similarly mild temperatures on Sunday. Then things turn colder next week. This is WG.